It's Wednesday, February 18th, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers, and welcome to the podcast. First in Stash News, just wanted to let folks know about my introduction of a new feature called the Virtual Bowl. And the idea here is that after I post the Stash at 4:20 p.m. Pacific time, I know that a lot of you are sitting around and listening to it. And since we can't pass a bowl between us through the ether of cyberspace, I figured we could at least share a discussion on a subject that might be interesting to those of us who use cannabis recreationally. My first question was the first time I smoked pot, and then just asked you to fill in the rest, and got some 30 comments there on that post. Very interesting stories from people. So every day after I've finished posting the Stash, I'll post a new virtual bowl. You can register for your account on the Stash, leave your comments on the virtual bowl, get to know some of the people on the Stash, and foster a great online community. Now just some interesting things I found as I was surfing around the internet today. I found an article in the San Francisco's The Snitch column. Well, they were talking about how Michael Phelps is continuing his career as a motivational speaker, and that coming to San Francisco, his performance has been headlined with the phrase, "Get fired up," which I thought was cute. Also, he's going to be going to Vancouver, and the performance in Vancouver is entitled High Performance. Yeah, we couldn't make this up, folks, but we did make up a couple of others. I thought it might be neat if a Phelps speech was advertised as smoking the competition or blazing the trail to excellence. One of our Stash readers, Gregor, came up with a couple of good ones, too. The seeds of success for the Michael Phelps speech, or hear me roar, referring, of course, to the roar bong that he was caught with, or my favorite one, I smoked two joints, and then I smoked two joints, and then I win a gold for Michael Phelps' speech. Great stuff, Gregor. Thanks for contributing that to the Stash. Also, one last bit before we get to the hemp headlines, and that was something that came up in Parade magazine. This is the insert that you get in most Sunday newspapers across the country. It's the largest circulation periodical in the United States, believe it or not. It's a story about the Axelrods, David Axelrod, the senior advisor to President Obama, and his wife Susan, and their daughter Lauren, who unfortunately suffers from an idiopathic form of epilepsy. And we just wanted to make the note that we hope that the Axelrods know that medical marijuana has been shown to have some fantastic results in helping to treat epilepsy. We've got a link to Valerie Corral's testimony, Valerie Corral from Wham out in California. She's a grand mal epilepsy sufferer, and she's been living with it for 36 years now, assisting herself through the use of cannabis. So you can contact the White House and encourage President Obama to pressure Congress to overturn the Barr Amendment. Now, this is the amendment that prevents the District of Columbia from implementing their medical marijuana law, which 69% of the residents of the district approved of. So if we could get that amendment overturned, perhaps the Axelrods could look into medical marijuana therapies for their daughter's epilepsy. All right, coming up on today's Stash, of course, it's Cannabis Science Day. So Dr. Mitch Earlywine is going to join us to talk about that cannabis and injury study that we looked at yesterday. And in a double dose of cannabis science, we are going to be speaking with the esteemed Dr. Lester Grinspoon from Harvard Medical, the author of Marijuana Reconsidered and Marijuana, the Forbidden Medicine. He's got a couple of great websites that he started he wants to tell us all about. And we're going to talk a little bit about the medical uses of marijuana. And in our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by Marijuana Music Awards, it's Reggae Wednesday. We're going to get some ganja weed from Ja Roots. So everybody get ready to feel irie, load up your chalice. It's time for your normal daily audio stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. DEA has 106 planes, so why did it spend $123,000 on a private plane? Washington, D.C. The head of the Drug Enforcement Administration spent more than $123,000 to charter a private jet to fly to Bogota, Colombia last fall instead of taking one of the agency's 106 planes. The DEA paid a contractor an additional $5,380 to arrange Acting Administrator Michelle Leonhardt's trip last October 28th through 30th with an outside company. The DEA scheduled this trip as the nation was reeling from the worst economic crisis in decades and the national debt was climbing toward $10 trillion. 3 weeks later, lawmakers slammed chief executive officers from three automakers for flying to Washington in private jets as Congress debated whether to bail out the auto industry. If one of the agency's jets isn't available for official trips, the DEA can borrow one from another federal agency to avoid racking up unnecessary costs to taxpayers. However, William Brown, the special agent in charge of the DEA's aviation division, said that he didn't consider seeking a loaner plane from another federal agency, although he said he had at least a week to schedule the flight. Brown said the administrator couldn't have taken a commercial flight because she and other officials who were traveling with her were under, quote, specific threat, unquote, in Colombia at the time. He wouldn't reveal details about the threat, saying only that it was of a, quote, sensitive law enforcement nature, end quote. He added that the threat prompted him to conclude that, quote, a government aircraft would provide a level of security not available on a commercial aircraft, end quote. A U.S. official in Colombia, however, said that officials there weren't aware of any threat against Leonhardt other than the general insecurity in the country due to the drug trade. The official wasn't authorized to speak to journalists and asked to remain anonymous. A private plane contracted in a rush for a Halloween week trip to Colombia? Did anyone think to check Leonhardt's bags for any suspicious white powders? You know, in the era of multi-billion dollar disappearances of pallet loads of $100 bills and multi-billion dollar bailouts, $123,745 taxpayer dollars seems kind of quaint. I like to think of Michelle Leonhardt's privilege to charter a private jet rather than use one of her own 106 planes or one of the federal government's planes or even spending the extra dough to fly commercial first class as just one young American whose entire college education could have been paid for. Did you know that the DEA's budget was $2.3 billion in fiscal year 2007? States looking to increase alcohol revenue during budget crisis. Salt Lake City. Utah is the only state that requires people to fill out an application and pay a fee before entering a bar. But the shelf life of this law, enacted 40 years ago in a state where nearly 2 out of 3 residents are members of a religion that shuns drinking, appears to be dwindling. In Utah and across the country, governors and lawmakers faced with budget deficits are advocating loosening laws that restrict alcohol consumption in the hopes of boosting tax revenues. In Georgia, Connecticut, Indiana, Texas, Alabama, and Minnesota, lawmakers are considering legislation this year that would end the ban on Sunday liquor sales. All but 15 states sell booze on Sundays. In Nebraska, a state lawmaker has proposed allowing beer to be consumed in state parks as a way to boost tourism. Other states, including Utah, are considering allowing the sale of liquor on Election Day. Drinkers shouldn't break out the bubbly just yet. 2 dozen states, including California, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, and Virginia, are looking to help their budgets by raising alcohol taxes. Earlier this month, distillers in Kentucky poured bottles of bourbon on the statehouse steps to protest a proposed tax increase. In Pittsburgh, a 10% tax placed on alcohol last year inspired an animated satire, resulted in some bars printing signs saying the tax's architect was not welcome, and one restaurateur challenging Allegheny County Executive Dan Onorato to a charity boxing match. Ben Jenkins, a spokesman for the Distilled Spirits Council, said states would be better off if they simply made alcohol more accessible to meet consumer demand. States that lift the ban on Sunday sales see a 5% to 8% annual sales increase, he said. Other states, meanwhile, are trying to eliminate much less onerous hassles associated with buying alcohol. In Colorado and Kansas, grocery stores are fighting for the right to sell full-strength beer. Most of the opposition in those states isn't coming from morality groups, but instead from liquor stores who like having a corner on the market. A similar effort is occurring in Tennessee, where lawmakers are considering the sale of wine in supermarkets. In Alabama, a proposal to raise the amount of alcohol allowed in beer from 6% alcohol by volume to 13.9% is being considered, although some church groups fear it would result in people getting drunker quicker. Incredible. Here you have a hard liquid drug that directly caused 21,000 deaths in 2005 just from poisoning the body's organs. It led to 11,000 fatal auto crashes in 2007 and addicted 14 million Americans. And the states are frantically trying to increase this drug's use and available potency, even as we've been somewhat successful in reducing this drug's use. And yes, alcohol is a hard drug. In my definition, drug equals manufactured intoxicant, and hard equals toxic and addictive. But nobody will speak about the elephant in the room, the untapped, untaxed marijuana market that kills and poisons no one. Jeffrey Myron of Harvard University estimated that the revenue from taxation and savings from no longer arresting, prosecuting, and imprisoning marijuana consumers would range from $10 to $14 billion annually. And that doesn't count revenues from spin-off industries like hemp and associated payroll and sales tax revenues. Dale Gueringer of California Normal estimates California alone would reap $8 to $13 billion annually when all the new jobs and taxes from legalized marijuana are realized. I'll never understand people who are afraid of legalized marijuana but accept bars with parking lots as normal. Bakersfield pot dispensary owner sentenced to 2.5 years. An employee at a local pot dispensary charged with conspiring to distribute scores of pounds of marijuana for several years was sentenced Tuesday in federal court to 30 months in jail. Timothy Doolittle, along with 7 others, was arrested in July 2007 at Bakersfield's Nature's Medicinal Inc., which had been operating at 323 Roberts Lane and is owned by co-defendants David Chavez Sr. and David Chavez Jr. At one point, Doolittle faced up to 20 years in prison. He pleaded guilty in November to the felony charges, but he was found to be a minor player in the operations, his attorney David A. Torres said. Doolittle worked at Nature's for 2 years, where he distributed about 188 pounds of marijuana from September 2004 to July 2007, according to the criminal complaint filed in court. The charges were part of an ongoing tension between state laws, which allow distribution of medicinal marijuana, and federal laws, which do not. Several pot dispensaries in Bakersfield shut down because of the crackdown. Protests rang out at the time of the crackdown. Medical marijuana advocates here, including Douglas McAfee, president of Bakersfield Normal, a pro-legalization group, called the bus, quote, an overreach of the federal government, end quote. 188 pounds of marijuana in that time period averages out to about 5.5 pounds a month, or about 4.5 ounces per business day. That hardly sounds like any major drug kingpin to me. Sounds to me like one Californian not paying any sales taxes or payroll taxes or income taxes for 2.5 years, and all of us taxpayers footing the bill for his room, board, and guarding for 2.5 years. And all the while, there will still be dispensaries and medical marijuana in California, no matter how many lives the federal government shatters.
Marijuana is an addictive drug, which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Caddo Parish, Louisiana, District Attorney Charles R. Scott's Reefer Madness. Responding to the Michael Phelps bong hit heard round the world, a Louisiana DA pens an article entitled, Hey Dude, Where's My Brain? In the Shreveport Times, under the heading of Con, Why Marijuana Should Remain Illegal, which confuses me because the con side of keeping marijuana illegal is legalization, and that's what Charles R. Scott opposes. Maybe the editors at the Times hit the bottle one too many times.
From 27 years' experience as a judge, I know marijuana is a gateway drug to more dangerous drugs, such as cocaine, methamphetamines, prescription medication, and heroin.
Well, that's new. How exactly is the marijuana you have to get illegally now the gateway drug to prescription medication? The only gateway for marijuana to other illicit drugs is the illegal marketplace where you have to purchase the marijuana. Nobody calls Bacardi 151 rum a gateway drug to cocaine because there's no cocaine for sale at the liquor store.
The legislature is right. Marijuana is a dangerous substance. It alters the mind and the heart. Look it up. In hundreds of cases, motorists with a joint or a blunt of marijuana place our citizens in danger. How would you explain to the parents of a child or to anyone who loses a loved one in an accident that could have been prevented if the drivers were not impaired or stoned on pot?
Well, I'd probably reuse one of the speeches you've used when somebody's child was lost in an alcohol-related crash, since that's a far more likely scenario than the stone driver killing anyone.
And what is it that leads someone to smoke pot? Is it to impress others? Is it to make the user feel better? How stupid is that?
Using something to make you feel better is stupid?
The way to build the esteem of others is to first have self-esteem. Without that, you have no hope of favorably impressing others. How can someone with low self-esteem improve their situation by using drugs that make them more vulnerable? If you are trying to impress your friends, what kind of friends would really want you to impair your perception or violate the law? I don't think friends let their friends get stoned.
Obviously, Mr. Scott is unaware that a friend with weed is a friend indeed.
Do you think you are smart enough to either start or maintain any type of career or life of responsibility with your brain impaired? I doubt it.
When the guy who wrote and starred in the hit astronomy series Cosmos, the late Dr. Carl Sagan, was a lifelong user of cannabis, I think it is safe to say you can be smart enough to maintain a career. I know me and millions of pot smokers with successful careers and lots of responsibility agree with me.
And what about the talk of legalizing marijuana? Think of how much easier it would be for the kids to get it then.
84% of high school seniors find marijuana easy or fairly easy to get now. Is it your contention that placing marijuana sales in adults-only stores and subjecting it to strict over 18 or over 21 identification checks will make it easier for teens to get than from their in-school no-carding weed dealer?
And think of the lifestyle that would go with a society that would allow for the recreational use of marijuana.
Yeah, think of it. People behaving peacefully, enjoying art and music, becoming more creative, living in harmony with nature, laughing and sharing, avoiding violence and confrontation. Yeah, that sure is scary.
Would that stop the illegal drug trade? It seems to me the use of drugs would be promoted. Manufacture, distribution, and possession of heroin, methamphetamines, and prescription drug abuse would continue. So what would have been accomplished?
Raising billions of dollars in revenue and taxation while reallocating our limited police budgets to address manufacture, distribution, and possession of heroin, methamphetamines, and prescription drug abuse? That's all that we'd accomplish by the legalization of marijuana.
Georgia.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson, and I need your help. Alcohol prohibition didn't work in the 20s, and marijuana prohibition isn't working today. It's time we stop arresting law-abiding citizens because they prefer marijuana over alcohol. Nearly 2,000 Americans are arrested every day on marijuana charges. We're unfairly destroying the lives and careers of hundreds of thousands of people each year simply because they smoke marijuana. These are not criminals. They're average citizens like you, good neighbors who work hard, raise families, pay taxes, and contribute to their communities. We need your help to end marijuana prohibition once and for all. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid, and which claims
are reefer madness?
Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with NORML's look at
cannabis science.
In yesterday's Daily Audio Stash, I had brought up a study that had been published showing some interesting results when they looked at people who had gotten into injuries and their use of alcohol, cannabis, or nothing at all 6 hours prior to that injury. And joining us to talk about that, of course, is Dr. Mitch Earlywine for our cannabis science segment. And welcome back, Dr. Mitch.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, you were just telling me that you've got kind of the inside scoop on this study. Tell us all about it.
Well, in truth, I was one of the anonymous reviewers for this journal when this article was first submitted, and I had actually been a little hard on it as far as publication is concerned. You probably went into this before, but the bottom line is these folks came to the emergency room, and they were asked, you know, did you use cannabis or did you use alcohol in the previous 6 hours for this injury? And then they did a really neat thing. They said, oh, and by the way, last week at this time, had you used cannabis or had you used alcohol? So then each person was sort of a control for him or herself, and then that way you avoid some of the problems with bias sampling that you get when you don't look at sort of case control design like that. And the results at first looked very encouraging. I thought it was really neat. We saw Generally, people were three times as likely to have used alcohol right before their injury than they had the previous week, which is consistent with a lot of other data on alcohol and injury. And, in fact, cannabis, they were only about a third as likely to have used right before the injury as they had the previous week. And, I mean, it's kind of laughable. It makes it look like marijuana is somehow protecting people against injury. However, as I read further and further in this paper, it turns out only 14 of almost 500 people had actually used cannabis prior to injury, which that in of itself is an intriguing finding. But then I don't want to make too much of this cannabis as a protective factor based on only 14 people.
Sure.
So definitely want to take this with a grain of salt, but it's pretty obvious that alcohol is certainly dangerous. You don't want to do anything dangerous after using alcohol. And we really don't have evidence that cannabis increases injuries in these kind of data. But I wouldn't go as far as to say this has some kind of protective factor.
Yeah, I was thinking more likely that the cannabis users might not be engaged in as risky activities as, say, the alcohol drinkers might. What do you think about that?
I find that a very compelling mechanism. And in fact, you know, we can all think of times when, you know, after using cannabis, people make a suggestion about something that sounds exotic or effortful or potentially dangerous, and everybody says, oh, yeah, that would be really cool, but not right now.
Yeah, and the joke I had made was, how injured can you be falling off the couch with your box of Lucky Charms? But
exactly. I mean, if it's not choking on a Twinkie, I think the injuries are going to be relatively minimal. I do want to emphasize that, you know, I don't know these researchers, and I feel like this was a great design. I feel like if they had waited until that part of the sample had been markedly bigger, even twice that size, I think it would have been more compelling. I'm glad this is getting some press, and I want to make sure everybody understands that the idea that cannabis causes injuries surely doesn't have any support here. But I just don't want them to go too far with this protective idea.
Is there any evidence with regard to, you know, looking at studies of driving or sports or any other activities where we see that cannabis users do tend to act more safely?
In fact, some of the stuff done with intoxicated driving in the Netherlands suggests that very thing. And although every time I bring it up, somebody in the crowd tends to, you know, boo me or throw things at me or things like that. It was pretty compelling. What had happened was essentially this was a driving test by Robbie, R-O-B-B-E, and he said, okay, we're going to get high, and now we're going to go drive. And people said, you mean outside? Like, you know, they really didn't quite understand the magnitude of the task. And they had to drive with a driving instructor right next to them. And the folks who had used cannabis were less likely to try to pass other cars. They tended to keep the distance between their car and the car in front of them larger. They were aware of this fact and tended to, you know, not tailgate in any sort of way. And they tended to increase their stopping distance. So they would start putting on the brake markedly earlier than folks who would not use cannabis, and literally, you know, miles before the other group that had used alcohol. I do want to emphasize that one, too, is I don't think cannabis is any kind of driving aid, but cannabis alone clearly didn't support, those data didn't support the idea that cannabis impaired driving. However, when they had cannabis and alcohol in that study, everything went out the window. People just really didn't know what they were doing, and obviously that's not a good idea as far as driving is concerned.
And you know, you bring up the cannabis and driving, and that leads me to some legislation that they're attempting to pass in Kentucky, this Senate Bill 5, which is another one of these per se DUID laws where any metabolite of marijuana means you're an impaired driver. Since that's a story that's kind of in the news right now, maybe you could give us a quick review of why this type of blood testing and metabolite testing for impairment is such a bad idea.
The problem invariably is that the metabolites don't develop until markedly later than the time the intoxication experience has ended. So for urine screens, you could have smoked 2 weeks ago and, you know, been involved in something and had positive metabolites, and people would say, well, you have metabolites, and under these laws you could be prosecuted. even if you hadn't smoked in days before driving. And that's just completely unfair and pretty insane. And the blood test, it's not quite the same duration, but still, you could be completely unimpaired. And that's why I've been plugging these roadside sobriety tests. We've discussed this a bit at the normal conference, and Dale Gerringer's been real clear about how these work. And just have somebody come to the side of the road and do these various motor tasks, and then you can identify who's really impaired. If they can't do these motor tasks, it correlates relatively highly with their ability to drive. And then you find that, you know, Benadryl, other antihistamines, just being tired, you know, all these other things that are actually impairing driving, we could get people to, you know, stop driving under those kind of predicaments instead of basically persecuting someone for having cannabis metabolites when, in fact, they weren't even driving high.
And in speaking about impaired driving, I also wanted to bring another thing by you here and get your reaction to it. And this is a story I was working on where all these states that are now so strapped for cash because of the financial crisis are looking at ways of increasing alcohol sales, like beginning to have alcohol sales on Sundays. Utah is looking at loosening up its liquor laws and such. And as someone who studied alcohol as in-depth as you have, how much more chaos do you think we're unleashing if we're going to trade the revenue from alcohol sin taxes for, you know, the public devastation it might wreak?
I mean, I don't want to overstate the case, but it's definitely pretty clear from data both in this country, Australia, and in Europe that just the, you know, the higher density of alcohol establishments, leaving bars open later, and making alcohol more available tends to really cause problems in these domains, particularly the driving and the domestic abuse domains. Mm. And I feel like if we're not willing to either increase, enforcement and observation as far as these things are concerned, we shouldn't go this route. And in fact, I feel like this is something where the public has to sort of take over on this. We got to understand and make it clear to everyone we know, we don't think drunk driving is cool. If you want to have a beer somewhere, find some place you can walk to and use that. Drink at home. You know, do things to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen, because this is, you know, a life and death situation. This is as serious as it could possibly be. And the idea that, you know, somehow we're going to get cash and trade it for people's lives just really leaves me kind of nauseated and frightened. And so I think if states decide they want to take this tack, everybody there has really got to clamp down socially on, hey, this isn't cool. When we think about other things that were problem behaviors that decreased, a lot of times the mechanism was really through social sanctions. Smoking is a fine example. Mm-hmm. Cigarette smoking, you know, we didn't make it illegal, but suddenly anybody who wanted to smoke a cigarette was forced outside into the cold, literally, and what a surprise, it dropped. And I think we're going to have to do some comparable things with inappropriate behavior after drinking and make sure that everybody's more than willing to clamp down on this kind of behavior.
Yeah, I just find it amazing that America is so ready to turn over more revenues from alcohol and at the same time be forced to slash law enforcement budgets to police that alcohol. And they'll leave the untaxed marijuana market just sitting there and won't even talk about it.
And we're talking literally billions nationwide here. So I think that certainly in California, some of these conversations are opening up. I've been trying to rattle the cages here in New York, and I know Massachusetts has also taken some efforts in these directions. It's a real missed opportunity, as we've talked about time and again, and now is the time when we really could use this cash.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Erlewine, thanks again for joining us for Cannabis Science, and we'll speak to you again next week.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you, sir. It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Erlewine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Erlewine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Erlewine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today
through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. The battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling and refresh all you stashers for another day on the front lines of the drug war. Enjoy this cut from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com and visit our blog at stash.normal.org to learn how you can vote for your favorites and enter your Toker Tunes in the 2009 Marijuana Music Awards. Ja Roots has a reputation as one of America's most talented reggae bands. Lead singer Ross Josh's soulful vocals deliver thought-provoking content of love, oppression, and spirituality. Ja Roots' reggae sound is generously supplemented by dancehall rapper Iron, who flawlessly infuses their performances with an infectious, joyous, and frantic energy. The tightness of the band is apparent, with every member of the group an accomplished musician. The power Ja Roots generates is testament to authentic music performed by passionate artists. In the past 2 years, the group have performed at numerous music and reggae festivals, including South by Southwest, Schwagstocks, and the High Times Reggae Fest. Ja Roots have recently performed with the Marley Children, Bunny Wailer, George Clinton, and many more. Their latest CD, Joy, features Junior Marvin, lead guitarist for Bob Marley and the Wailers. Junior Marvin is featured on today's song by Ja Roots, Ganja Weed, which won the 2008 Global Marijuana Music Awards Best Reggae Song. Grab the CD Joy on iTunes and check out Ja Roots at goodhighs.com. That's GoodHighs.com and myspace.com/JaRoots. This is your daily Toker tune from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com. It's Ganja Weed by Ja Roots.
Ganja weed, you did destroy every day and on both days. You're the one on the spring. Got what ganja is, your drugs they push on us every day. On TNBA, your money's sponsoring it.
The earth is a part of our environment. You try to take it away and I shall burn you till retirement. You make your love to come and try prevent it. Then you settle my freedom with this sentence, I shall not regret it. I try to testify on its importance. Until you make a month work too important. But you cannot justify the way you torment all the people smoking earth and just enjoying it.
So listen, tell Joey, you're the destroyer.
I can't just sit back and observe this now. How dare you take away this gift and make it seem so wrong? Well, I know that you're confused. Look at the way you treat your brother, man who never wronged you. How can I make it much more clear to you? We'll never stop burning up no matter what you're gonna do.
Ganja weed, you'll be destroyed. I got what ganja is.
our phones don't go till they get back. You think they take a breath and think about urban and drill it back. You can't deny the ganja and the positive it back. It'll change the way you live and take the evil about your ass.
So they said, ganja weed, gonna destroy everything. And on 4 days, heaven and war in the spring. You're what ganja is. Your drugs, they push on us and everything.
Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORMA. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORMAL, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Dr. Lester Grinspoon is an associate professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School and also the author of several groundbreaking drug-related books, including Marijuana Reconsidered, Psychedelic Drugs Reconsidered, and Marijuana the Forbidden Medicine. He's been a longtime advocate for the medical use of marijuana, and he joins us today on the Daily Audio Stash to talk about a new online endeavor. So, Dr. Grinspoon, thank you, and it's our pleasure to have you here on the Stash.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you were one of the first physicians to take a look at the use of cannabis as medicine, you know, going back to your publishing of these books in the 1970s. What do you think about the progress that's been made on medical marijuana since you first began looking at the issue?
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I mean, there's no question now, medical marijuana is here to stay. And I don't want to get too far into that topic, but I must say that my major worry is in that area is not so much whether marijuana is now going to be accepted as a medicine. There's no question in my mind about that. But how to keep it, a people's medicine, as herbal marijuana, and not to let the drug companies get away with trying to patent strains and make it... They can only be successful in producing cannabinoid analogs and other cannabinoid-based medicines, for the most part, in the shadow of this prohibition. That is to say, from our experience so far, if you take a patient who's used Marinol, or Sativex, and a patient who has used both Marinol and herbal marijuana, it's a very rare patient who would say he prefers Marinol or Sativex to herbal marijuana.
Yeah.
In my experience, the patients who do are patients who are concerned about it not being legal. And they want to use a cannabinoid medicine, but not have to deal with the vagaries of the law.
Yeah.
But that's another story. What I really wanted to talk today about is something that I've become increasingly interested in. You know, when I first got started looking at marijuana in 1967, I did it because I was concerned that so many young people were using this foolishly, using this very dangerous medicine. And I believe that if I could write a reasonably objective paper, then perhaps some of them who would not believe what the government was saying about it would believe something that was clearly data-based. So I went into the Conway Library, the Harvard Medical School Library, and spent a lot of time reading everything I could get my hands on this, and then wrote a paper which was published in Scientific American, which made the point that marijuana, that I had been duped like just about every other citizen of the United States. But there was less excuse for me to have been brainwashed because I was trained in science and medicine.
Yeah.
And that the truly dangerous thing about marijuana was not any inherent psychopharmacological property of the drug or any other property of it, but rather the way we as a society were dealing with this problem. That is, by arresting at that time about 300,000 people. Of course, as you know, it's over 800,000 now. Mm-hmm. Sadly, I made the prediction in Marijuana Reconsidered, which was published by Harvard University Press in 1971, that there was no doubt that the prohibition would be gone within 10 years. In fact, Carl Sagan, who was a very close friend of mine, read the manuscript, and he said he liked the book a lot, but he said, Lester, aren't you being conservative? You think it's going to take 10 years? And that was in 1970. So
wow.
I'm not a very good prognosticator, but at any rate, it was that experience that helped me to begin to learn that it was not only a drug used for recreation, but it was a drug that had a very interesting past as a medicine, a past which in Western society began in about the mid-19th century and went on until two things happened. The Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, the first of the draconian legislation against marijuana, was passed. And before that, at about the turn of the century, both acetyl salicylic acid, or aspirin, and barbiturates were synthesized within 2 years of each other.
Hmm.
Now, so doctors now had, if somebody had pain, here, take a nice clean aspirin pill here.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to get all messy with this here marijuana stuff. Although, of course, they didn't know about smoking, but they didn't know about what to prescribe as a dose either, because there were no bioassays that could tell them how much of any of the cannabinoids were in the let's say Tilden solution that they were. And that was used for pain, and then for sleep, it was used as sleep medicine a lot. And well, now we had these various barbiturates coming out of the pharmaceutical companies, and so physicians were less interested. And so, because of the 1937 Act and the fact that we now had synthetic drugs like aspirin, of course, which was everybody believed as safe as marijuana. But of course, about 1,000 to 2,000 people every year in this country lose their lives to aspirin.
Sure.
But nevertheless, physicians lost interest. The government was able to pass the 1937 marijuana tax, and while it did not explicitly exclude its use as a medicine, it made the paperwork so difficult that physicians, it just wasn't worth it to them. And we medicine allowed itself to become quite ignorant about what this medicine could do, so it just went out of the pharmacopoeia and out of physicians' minds. But at any rate, in 1993, I wrote the book Marijuana, the Forbidden Medicine, and it's fair to say that that is clearly established now. The only people who don't really understand that is the people in the U.S. government. most other people do. But, you know, and I, at once, for a while, I thought that here were the two major reasons why people use marijuana. One, because it can be a lot of fun. And two, it is a remarkable medicine. It's remarkably free of toxicity. It's very versatile. It can deal with a whole bunch of symptoms and syndromes. And three, one could imagine that once it's free of the prohibition tariff, which makes it so damned expensive, it will be much less expensive than the many conventional medicines that people will no longer use because they're more toxic for many things and less efficacious. And then, more recently, I've been thinking that there's a third category, recreation medicine and what I've come to call enhancement, that using marijuana can enhance one's personal experiences in a whole variety of areas. Now, everybody knows that how it enhances taste, so much so that people can eat some very ordinary meal and think of it as a culinary treat.
Yeah.
And many people are aware of the fact that it, many people, that is the people who use it, are aware of the fact that it can be an enhancer of the sexual experience and spiritual experiences and so forth. But I believe there are many other areas of enhancement, like creativity. People who write, for example, Carl Sagan clearly found it useful in his writing. Many other people have reported that. People not only for producing the graphic arts, but people like myself who get more out of going to a museum if I've altered my state of consciousness a little bit in the way that that marijuana is capable of doing. In fact, Allen Ginsberg, who wrote in the Atlantic magazine, I believe it was, in the late 60s, about how he was having difficulty in really catching on to Cezanne. He knew that people, you know, regarded him as a very important artist of that time, and he never quite saw it. So he wrote about his experience of having a little grasp before he went to the Museum of Modern Art in New York and looked at Cezanne. And of course, he writes so beautifully, and it was amazing to him how Cezanne came across as he never did before. And it wasn't just a dose-related phenomenon, because he asserts that what he learned, what he was able to internalize about Cezanne, stuck to his ribs. And Cezanne now is one of the artists whom he gets a great deal of pleasure out of. So So I started this website called The Uses of Marijuana. It's www.marijuana-uses.com, in which I spent quite a bit of money advertising in magazines, and every one of the magazines took the ad, but The New Yorker refused to publish an ad which asked people who had significant experiences with cannabis to share in an essay with me what they thought it was doing for them, and started to put them together on this website. And now, you know, Carl Sagan's essay was there. Carl wrote it for my book, Marijuana Reconsidered, in late 1969, but we called it Mr. X. He didn't want, of course, his name known at that time. And many people, I've always been open about my use, but that's another area. Many people have put those essays up either anonymously or with a pseudonym, but there are a large number of essays there about many different ways in which people find marijuana enhances some aspect of their life in a very positive way. And recently I decided to add a blog to that so that people, as of this week, can start, they can still submit essays. We're always open to essays. We don't take a lot of them, so many of them read like this. I'm 17 years old, and I use dope, and I think it's great. And you can publish this with my name. But the ones we publish, the ones I put up there, are thoughtful essays, which are pretty well written and articulated. We do very little. I do very little editing of them. And the same will be true of the blog. In fact, some comments on the blog have already come up, and there are misspellings there, and you know, they go right to it, and I said, is there any way I can at least correct them? And my webmaster said, no, once they're up there, they're up there. But at any rate, so we are now accepting blogs and comments and what have you around that website, but I want to emphasize we're still building up this collection of essays.
All right.
So that, in a nutshell, is what I'm up to on this.
Okay, well, the website is, like you mentioned, marijuana-uses.com, and we'll have a link to that up at our blog at stash.normal.org. We've also got Dr. Grinspoon's banner advertisement running in the Stash, so as you're reading down the posts, you'll probably see Dr. Grinspoon's smiling face and a link to the blog, so you can click on it and read it yourself. And they are still taking essays, essays on your uses of marijuana, how it has enhanced the effects in your life and your personal experience with it. Is there a way they submit those, Doctor, through an email or anything?
Yes, if they go to the website marijuana-uses.com, there will be, I think the last block is, I forget what it's called, but it tells you how to reach me.
Great.
It gives my email address. And that's how the essays come in. And I respond to everybody. I don't take all the essays, but I do respond to them. And I expect now that some people who, you know, see an essay as a real tip, would love to have a paragraph or two about this. And that might be more appropriate to the blog, or some criticism of an essay or what have you. I mean, what I want to do is get a conversation going on, you know, so much of the attention is to, you know, how toxic is marijuana, how much fun is marijuana, how good it is the medicine. But I think too little attention has been paid to this very special capacity it has, namely to enhance a variety of experiences.
I agree, Dr. Grinspoon, and I'm glad you're taking those essays so that people can express themselves anonymously if they want to, or to put their name on it if they feel confident in stepping out like that. That's, I think, the best way we can fight this stupid prohibition and maybe get it overturned sometime,
you know,
in our lifetimes.
That's exactly how I feel, yeah. Russ. I, from the very beginning, said we're never going to get over this unless we feel that, you know, the people who hardworking, you know, people who just don't correspond to the propaganda stereotype of the lazy ne'er do well hippie person who just goes around smoking dope. You know, I think it's very much analogous to the homosexual situation.
Mm-hmm.
People started to come out of the closet a couple of decades ago, and I think that has done an awful lot to reduce homophobia in this mm-hmm. country. Now, it's clear we're not where we've got to be eventually, but this past election showed us that we've come a long ways. And I think when people, that's why I would rather have people put their names to this, but I don't want that to be the reason. You know, I can certainly understand someone who doesn't want to do that and wants to be anonymous or use a pseudonym, but I think ultimately it's when enough people have made it clear to other people that that they can use this, and like Michael Phelps won 14 yeah. medals.
Yeah,
he's not likely to write an essay, though.
I don't think so.
He might write a letter to the Kellogg Company, but not an essay from my website.
Maybe so. Well, Dr. Lester Grinspoon, like I mentioned, is a professor emeritus of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, also running the website marijuana-uses.com, and another great website, rxmarijuana.com, where you can get a lot of individual anecdotes about medical uses of marijuana. And of course, the groundbreaking books, Marijuana Reconsidered, Psychedelic Drugs Reconsidered, and Marijuana, the Forbidden Medicine. If you haven't checked them out and read them, you need to. Dr. Grinspoon, thank you so much for helping us out here on The Stash today.
Well, thank you so much for helping me to get people interested.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. Leave you today with a reminder to set your DVR to record The Bill O'Reilly Show on Fox News. MPP's Executive Director Rob Campy will be there to debate him on the legalization of marijuana. Also, to make it easier to find out the latest events on the Normal Daily Audio Stash activist agenda, I've shortened the web link. Now you can just point your browser to stash.normal.org/agenda. And another cannabis quote brought to you by Stasher Mr. Spoff from Abraham Lincoln, who said, quote, "This country, with its institutions, belongs to the people who inhabit it. Whenever they shall grow weary of the existing government, they can exercise their constitutional right of amending it or their revolutionary right to dismember or overthrow it." End quote. Something to think about. Thanks for downloading The Stash. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews you can use for the cannabis community. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.